Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, and welcome to yet another installment of Behind the Screen. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker, and I produce the RPG podcast Game Master's Journey, and I DM the D&D campaign Hinterlands of Alandria, which is also on this channel. So what this is, this series, is me talking about the campaign from the perspective of the DM, from behind the screen, talking about how I create the adventures, how I run the sessions, all that good stuff, in the hopes of helping you, fellow GMs, learn from what I'm doing, whether I'm doing things right or not so right. And I've gotten a lot of great feedback from people who are enjoying what I'm doing here. So thank you very much. I really appreciate that. I, however, would love to get more feedback, specifically feedback in the form of questions, comments, and topics that I can talk about on these episodes. So again, if you're watching the actual play and you have a comment or a question, please feel free to leave a comment on the YouTube video. Or if you're watching these behind the screens and you have a comment or a question, please leave a comment on that video. Now, this is the first of the behind the screens that I'm not live streaming. And that's because I think it's very likely today that I'll get into some spoilers as far as where we are in the campaign right now. And just to give you an idea, as of recording this, we have played, let me check here, but I believe we have played 5 sessions. So I am recording this between the 5th and 6th session of the actual play. And today I'm going to be talking about the 2nd session. So already things are getting a little timey-wimey here, but that's just the way it is. So I'm very quickly getting to the end of the episodes that I wrote when I first started the campaign. So I'm going into a lot of detail on the first few sessions, but due to the production of this and kind of the way this is working, I didn't want to keep doing that because these are already quite a bit behind of the actual play itself, and I'm only now starting to get into spoiler territory. So I don't want to end up with too large of a backlog of these behind the screen episodes, and also without feedback from you in the form of questions and comments on these episodes, I'm not exactly sure what people want me to talk about, what people maybe need more clarification on. So I don't want to go too crazy producing these before I get that feedback and I know more what direction you'd like me to take with this. So as we go forward, after I'd say the next 2 or 3 episodes of Behind the Screen, we will more and more be shifting into my responding to your comments and questions as far as guiding these episodes, and less stuff that I prepared a long time ago. But I've found in my days as a game master that a lot of the time and effort put into a campaign as far as preparation on the part of the GM is really at the beginning of the campaign. It's very front loaded. You will spend a lot of your time and effort before you even start the campaign and during the weeks that you're running those first few sessions. And at least in my experience, as a campaign goes on longer and longer in time, there's less and less for you to do as a GM week to week because you've laid all that groundwork already. So I think it's appropriate that we spend more time talking about the beginning of the campaign than we necessarily do going forward. But again, if there's anything you want me to talk about, if there's any questions you have, please let me know. In addition to commenting on the videos, if you have something more extensive you'd like to say, you could also shoot me an email at lexstarwalker@gmail.com. All right. So today I'm talking about session two, the Hinterlands, and I am going to be relying a lot on my notes and what I wrote weeks ago at this point. It's been a while since I ran session two, so I'm going to rely more on my notes than my memory, and hopefully we can get through this without me getting too confused. So the first scene of session two consisted of the player characters making camp. So we're picking up right where we left off with the last session. And during this scene, I have an encounter with some needle blights. And this is an encounter that occurs while the player characters are at camp, while they're resting and taking their watches and things like that. And as I've said time and again on the series, anytime I start thinking about an encounter I want to run, I always have a goal or a purpose, what I'm trying to accomplish with that encounter. And I always keep that in the front of my mind as I'm designing the encounter. So my goal with this first encounter with the needle blights was to simply show that there are blights in the forest. This is relating to and foreshadowing some things that are going to happen later in the campaign. And I don't really need to go into detail about that right now, so we can avoid spoilers and I can put this video out sooner rather than later. But for now, just suffice it to say that these blights, we will see blights again. And this directly ties into one of the storylines of the early part of the campaign. And so I wanted to have an encounter with blights to foreshadow that, to establish, hey, these kinds of creatures are around, and maybe possibly pique the player's interest and make them wonder what's going on with these blights. But that would be icing on the cake. Really, the purpose is just to establish that blights exist, so that later in the story, when they encounter the blights again, they can be like, oh yeah, I remember these guys. This also relates to a vision that Bryn had. And so really quickly, I should tell you that there is one little piece of content of the campaign that unfortunately you as the viewer didn't get access to, even though we record all our sessions, and even though I even recorded the preludes that I did with the players, there are still things that happen on our forum and over email that unfortunately you just don't see. And one of those things that happened was before we started the first session. So between the end of the preludes and the first session, I sent an email to each player, and I had each player character at some point in their past have something strange that happened to them. And it kind of varied from character to character. For some of them, it was a weird thing that happened. For some of them, it was a strange dream that they have that stuck with them, or a vision that they had that stuck with them. And especially in Primordia, it can be very difficult to tell the difference between a vision and a dream. And a lot of times they're the same thing. There isn't really a difference. But that's a whole can of worms, another topic for another day. So Phoebe's character, Bryn, who is the Firbolg druid, in her vision, saw this twisted and evil tree. And, you know, I'm just thinking out loud here, but if you're interested in those visions, if you'd like to know what those entailed, let me know. And if I hear from people that are interested, maybe I can get that to you some way. I could maybe just post the text from the email somewhere as far as what the visions were, or maybe I could share them with you on a future episode of Behind the Screen. So if you'd like to know more about the visions that each of the player characters had, let me know. All right. So anyway, Bryn has this vision about this twisted and evil tree. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because I don't want to get too spoilery with this, so that I can release this sometime relatively soon. But at this point, when I'm doing this encounter, I'm kind of hoping that Phoebe, the player, will maybe make a connection between these evil plant creatures that attack them in the woods and this dream she had about a twisted and evil tree. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. And you know, that's the thing as a game master, you know, when we plan encounters or whatever we're planning to do in a session, things don't always work out the way that we think they will or the way that we hope they will. And players don't always figure things out that we think that they will figure out or that we hope they will figure out, or they don't always think of the specific things that, that you hope that they think about. And that's just part of being a game master. And, it's just something you have to learn to deal with and compensate for. And the way I do that personally is I always hedge my bets, and I always have some kind of alternative. And I also try especially when it comes to like foreshadowing and stuff like what I'm doing here, I always try to do it sooner rather than later. So I'm hoping that this encounter with the Blights can kind of foreshadow this thing that's coming later. But in order for it to do that really well, the players kind of need to make this connection between these creatures and this vision that Phoebe's character had. And they don't make that connection, but that's okay, because it's early enough in the campaign. We have enough time before that element of the story will come into play anyway, that I will have other opportunities to try to foreshadow this again. And so that's one trick I use is if I know something is coming in the future and I want to foreshadow, I want to set that up ahead of time, so when it happens, it makes sense that it happened. I do that as early as I possibly can, just in case things don't go the way I want. So I can try again and again until what I need to happen happens. So this is a perfect example of that. And it's interesting, as I'm recording this, as I said, we've already played through the first five sessions, and there's a part coming up where the player characters hear about a magical tree and, as a possible solution to a problem that they have. And I don't want to say too much in case you're not that far in the story yet. I don't want to spoil it for you, but they hear about this magical tree, which has nothing actually to do with this twisted and evil tree that Bryn saw in her vision. But Phoebe remembered her vision and is associating these two things and is thinking that this magic tree that they're now pursuing is going to be this tree that she saw in her vision. It's not. So that's fine, you know, and that's another example of, you know, things not playing out the way that I thought they would, and players taking the information I'm giving them and drawing conclusions from them. And some of those conclusions are correct, some of them aren't, but it's all good. I can work with all of it. So, you know, really this is setting up my next opportunity to foreshadow this thing that's coming later if I want to, because presumably when the PCs get to this magic tree, Phoebe is going to figure out, and her character Bryn is going to figure out, oh, hey, this actually has nothing to do with that vision that I had, which means that vision that I had is something else out there that's going on that we haven't even scratched the surface yet. And at that point, she might, you know, think back to this encounter and remember that. Or at that point, that would be a great time for me to have another encounter with the Blights, or something else that can give a little bit more information and be a little less vague. And that can be the foreshadowing, and that can kind of be the clue that will lead them on to the next thing. And while we're talking about foreshadowing and setting up clues, you know, it's kind of like breadcrumbs, right? You're dribbling these little breadcrumbs through the adventure that you hope that the players will follow, that are going to lead them to the next thing you want to get to. And when you foreshadow like this, another technique that I use is the earlier I'm foreshadowing something. So I have something that's coming in the future that I want to foreshadow, right? Let's call that the event that's coming, right? The earlier before that event I'm foreshadowing it, the more vague those hints or clues or foreshadowings are, the nearer to the event the foreshadowing gets, the more specific it gets. And the reason for this is because ideally, when the time for the event comes, ideally, I've foreshadowed it more than once, hopefully a few times, so that when the players finally figure out what's going on, they can have this aha moment and be like, oh, this is what's happening. And actually, we have these clues from previous sessions that feed into this theory we now have of what's happening, and it all fits together and it makes sense. And the more of those foreshadowings you can have that they can piece together, or the more of those clues you've given them, or those pieces of the puzzle that they can piece together, the more fun that aha moment is going to be, and the more confident they can be in their new understanding of what's going on. But if I'm going to give numerous clues to this event, numerous foreshadowings beforehand, I have to be careful that I don't give the thing up right away, right? So I don't, the first clue I give, I don't want it to be a very specific clue that could lead the PCs or the players to the answer, right? I don't want them to find the answer yet. So that's why the earlier clues are more vague, and like this blight thing. I mean, honestly, it would take quite a leap, I think, for Phoebe at this point to make a connection, because it is so vague. And also, at this point that this encounter happens, Phoebe is the only one that knows about that vision, because I handled these through private emails, and the players haven't discussed their visions with one another. I was kind of hoping that they would do that, but it makes sense that they wouldn't right away, because their characters don't know each other real well. I just hope that by the time the players' characters know each other well enough to talk about these weird visions or things that happen to them, that they haven't forgotten about them at that point. But because those visions and things were loaded with foreshadowing and things that will come into play later and make sense later, which makes me think again that maybe I should make that available to you guys. So let me know if you'd like that. So this is a very vague kind of clue to what's to come, but completely understandable that it kind of went over the players' heads, because it was probably too vague. But that's okay, because again, this is really early. I've got lots of time, lots of game sessions before this thing happens that I'm trying to foreshadow. So I have lots of opportunities to foreshadow it and give hints to it more directly. So with this encounter, I wasn't trying to kill the player characters. I didn't care about the encounter being super challenging or hard or deadly or anything like that. I wasn't even concerned with the encounter giving them a serious threat. So, you know, one thing to think about as a GM, you know, there's all the prep we do to set up a game, but then there's also how we run the game at the table. And part of being a GM is improvising and adjusting, changing what you're doing on the fly during play in response to what the players are doing. And this is when it can be really helpful to always keep in mind your purpose, why you're doing what you're doing. So for example, this encounter, my purpose is just to show that the blights exist, give the players a fun combat encounter, and that's really it. I don't care about it being super challenging or a serious threat or anything like that. So when I run the encounter, I'm just going to run the encounter and let the chips fall as they may. On the other hand, if with this goal I was wanting it to be a challenge, then that might be something where I'd use various strategies so that I could adjust the difficulty of the encounter on the fly so that it would be truly a challenge. So maybe I establish that, well, there's not just the 6 or 7 blights that are in the PC's camp that they're fighting, but there's also more blights that they hear around them that can enter the fray at any moment, so that if the encounter is too easy, I can bring more blights in and make it the level of challenge that I want. So that's the way I would run that encounter if one of my goals with the encounter was to give the players a real challenge. But that isn't my goal with this. So I did If I remember right, it's been a while since I ran this session, but I believe I did at least hint that there were more blights in the forest than what they saw and what they fought. But I didn't bring them into the combat because, again, I wasn't concerned with how challenging the combat was. I just wanted them to have an encounter with blights. That was really it. So I didn't see any point in like drawing it out and bringing in more blights and trying to, you know, really give them a challenge. But it was kind of nice to establish that there were more blights in the area. And you remember I did the same kind of thing with the manticore encounter earlier. So that I kind of am setting a precedent of, you know, that's how things work in this game. That's how things work in Primordia. You know, just because you have an encounter with six blights doesn't mean those are the only blights around. Doesn't mean that there aren't 30 blights in the nearby area and you're just facing six of them right now. And so that way in the future, when I use that as a technique to kind of dial in the difficulty of an encounter, the players are already used to that. They've already seen that happen before, and they've seen it happen in a situation where they knew there were more bad guys out there, but thankfully they never engaged. Well, now we're in a situation where reinforcements do engage. So, it's always good to almost kind of train your players, right? Not to be insulting, but it is kind of like training them, right? Of, you know, this is what you can expect. This is how things work. And it's just really important as a GM to be consistent so the players can figure out the logic of your game and start to anticipate and make smart decisions. So another nice thing about not being concerned about this being a challenging encounter is there's always a possibility that it will be a really easy encounter. And I don't think you want to have too many easy encounters in your game because if you have too many, they just get boring and they become a slog and they feel like a waste of time. But it is nice for the players to occasionally have an encounter that they can overcome handily and easily because it makes them feel powerful and it makes them feel like their characters are powerful, which is cool. It's part of the reason people play these games. So it's a good thing to do once in a while. You know, it's like seasoning. I always like to make the analogy to spices with these GMing techniques, like salt, right? You make a dish, you don't use any salt. It's bland, uninteresting, and has no flavor. If you use some salt, the right amount of salt, it's night and day. It's this delicious, wonderful dish with all these flavors, right? On the other hand, if you use too much salt, it's disgusting. So it's the same kind of thing with all of these techniques we talk about as GMs. You know, it's not just do this thing, but it's how you do it. It's your technique and it's your, how often you use this particular technique, right? So there's a lot of art to it. So, you know, the players got a chance to feel like their characters are powerful, to be able to take on something that they're more than a match for. Like I said, there were other blights about, and I think the players realized that. And I kind of let them know that as the blights retreated. So I could have brought more in to make it more challenging if that's what I wanted to do, or I could have done waves or things like that, but I didn't want to do that. And again, there are going to be plenty of opportunities for the player characters to face, blights in the future. And, you know, those encounters can be more challenging, but for right now, it's not necessary. All right, so our next encounter in that session, the player characters defeat the blights. They go back to sleeping and keeping their watches. And then a couple of the characters are on watch and hear a voice out in the woods, a woman's voice trying to lure them out into the woods. Players didn't fall for it and characters didn't fall for it. And this remains a bit of a mystery. They weren't really able to figure out what was going on with this encounter. They suspect that it's some kind of fey creature. Right now it seems like the popular theory is that it's a pixie in this session and sessions since, they keep referring to it as a pixie. So the players have decided it's a pixie. They don't know for sure what it is, but they think it's some kind of fey creature. But they have this encounter with some kind of entity, you know, uses an attractive feminine voice to try to lure them out into the woods, appears to them in a glowing form, and lures them out of the camp, and then Wall is blinded by this flash of light. And you know, there's a little bit of chaos because they thought maybe they were being attacked, and when the dust settles, all their belongings in the camp have been rifled through. All their packs and sacks and things have been emptied, and the contents have been arranged in interesting patterns around the camp, which is the point where they realize, okay, this seems to be something pranking us, not necessarily malicious. And I think it was Larissa, Manny's character, Larissa, the glamour bard, who has spent time in the Feywild, who realized, you know, this is very similar to the behavior of a lot of Fey creatures that she's familiar with, and how they like to pull pranks, and they have this kind of different sense of humor. So this is actually another kind of foreshadowing. This is a thing I like to set things up before I do them, and this is a great way to bring a feeling of realism into your game and make the world seem like it's a natural place where there's cause and effect, and things are happening because of things that happened previously. So this is actually setting up an NPC that I hope will be a larger part of the campaign going forward. And this is, you know, one of those situations where it's completely up to the players what happens with this NPC. This NPC, this could be the last we see of them, never really become a part of the story, or they could very much become a part of the story. They could be an ally to the player characters. They could be an enemy of the player characters. They could be completely indifferent to the player characters. And it completely depends on how the characters react and what the players decide to do. It's all how they play their cards. So I will say at this point, it is a type of fey creature. I won't tell you what it is. We'll save some surprises for the future. So this is also kind of foreshadowing and setting up, future events that I anticipate will happen, when the players' characters start, exploring the fairy forest, which is another region nearby. Assuming they ever decide to go there, they may not. It's going to be up to them. However, considering that Manny's character, Larissa, is a College of Glamour bard and spent time in the Feywild, I think it's a fairly safe bet that at some point in the campaign, they're going to go check out the fairy forest, but we'll see. I've never been super good at predicting what players will do. All right, so that's basically scene one. So we've got a scene of them in camp. We've got a couple encounters, one combat, one not. And then they sleep the rest of the night and wake up the next morning. So the second scene of this session is they're searched for the village. And this will include another encounter. And this encounter is with an ogre that they come across while they're trying to find the village, Dianara's Rest. So this I intended to be a truly challenging encounter for the PCs. I thought this will be their first really challenging fight. And, you know, it'll be a chance for them to kind of prove themselves. You know, up to this point, they've faced opponents who were either fairly evenly matched or were not as powerful as the PCs, or maybe were evenly matched, but were just outnumbered by the PCs. So this was the first chance for them to fight something on their level, maybe even a little above, something that they could kind of feel some pride in defeating if they managed to defeat it. And also would be my first chance to give them some treasure. Which honestly was one of the big motivators for me to do this encounter, is just because of the nature of this campaign and the adventures and what I have planned for the beginning of it, especially for the beginning, like the tier one stuff, like levels 1 to 5 or so. There's not a lot of really natural opportunities to hand out treasure to the player characters. And I always like, well, I like everything in my games to make sense, right? And I especially like it to make sense when player characters get treasure. So I don't just, you know, give them treasure willy nilly. You know, there's got to be a reason that they're getting the treasure. It's got to make sense. But on the other hand, I want to give them treasure, and I'd like to at least be somewhat close to the guidelines that were given in the game as far as how much treasure player characters should have access to at a given point in their careers. And I'm well below that curve right now, other than I did give them all an uncommon magic item. So actually, I'm probably okay. I'm a little below the curve, I think, as far as how much monetary treasure I've handed out. And I'm a little below the curve as far as the number of kind of minor items that I've handed out, like consumables, like potions and scrolls and things like that. But as far as bona fide magic items, I'm probably right where I need to be, because I did give every character an uncommon item to start with, that are fairly nice items. But I know in, you know, the design of this campaign that there aren't a lot of opportunities for treasure. So I'm always on the lookout for an encounter I can use that can also be a believable way for the player characters to find some treasure. And, you know, a lot of the things they've been encountering are animals or monsters that don't, you know, carry things around. You know, like dinosaurs don't have pockets that they keep money and magic items in, right? So an ogre, on the other hand, is a sort of intelligent humanoid that does have pockets and do have possessions and tools and things like that. So it would make sense that an ogre might have some kind of treasure. So I foreshadowed the fact that this ogre might have treasure, because when the PC that was scouting ahead saw the ogre was rummaging through a large sack that he was carrying. And the PC heard the tinkling of metal items banging together as the ogre's rummaging through the sack, which was kind of me trying to telegraph, hey, this ogre's got some treasure, you guys. However, the players wisely, I think, but again, this was not what I expected them to do, decided to avoid the ogre entirely. I kind of go back and forth whether I think this was a little metagamey on the player's part. Definitely from the conversation that the players had, it was very metagamey, like, oh, you know, ogre's too high CR for us right now, we shouldn't fight this. Which I'm not a fan of, you know, players who approach the game in that way. I'd rather you are in your character's head and thinking, how would your character react? Not thinking about game mechanics, not metagaming. But this was an instance where, you know, they would have been the same. I would have preferred that they would have had those thoughts in character in that conversation in character and been like, this thing is big and scary looking, let's not fight it. Even if that was informed by metagame kind of stuff. But in this instance, I think either way you end at the same conclusion, which is, yeah, we don't want to deal with this right now. Which is not what I expected. And I'll hold this out as an example to all those people out there who say and seem to believe that players will never run away or players will never back down from a fight. It's just ridiculous. But there are people that believe that, and maybe there are players that play that way, but I tell you what, teach them differently. You know, I don't ever have players that play that way, because they learn really quickly if they play that way, that's a great way to lose your character. I run a thinking game. You know, I want my players to think. This isn't just, do roll dice, do damage, subtract hit points. You know, this isn't a computer RPG, right? Or a video game, right? This is, you know, I'd like to think on a higher level where you actually have to think creatively. And yeah. So, fleeing is always an option. Retreat is always an option. And I did not expect the players to avoid this fight, not because I believe that players will never run away, because I know that's not true. But because it was only one ogre, and even if some of the players knew what CR it was, I mean, there's six of them. they're a little overpowered for their level, I think, if only because they all have a decent magic item. So I would have thought that they would have gone for it and at least engaged it and see how it goes for a round or two and then maybe withdraw. But they elected to avoid it entirely. So again, this is an example that yes, players will avoid a fight. Players aren't stupid, just mindlessly running and attacking anything in sight. And it's also an example that I can't predict what players are going to do. And, that's okay. You probably can't predict what your players are going to do either. And that's fine. The point isn't to predict what your players are going to do. The point is to prepare in such a way that whatever the players decide to do, you're okay. And you know how to respond, which is what I shoot for. So the players wisely decide to avoid the ogre. And the players did make stealth a priority when making their characters. And this was something I told them as part of character creation that, you know, Primordia isn't the kind of world where people lumber around in heavy armor all the time. In the wilds of Primordia, it's likely more important to be stealthy than it is to be heavily armored, because there are things out there that are well beyond your abilities that you just don't want to attract the notice of. And it doesn't matter how thick your armor is. If the red dragon notices you, you're screwed. So better to be stealthy. And so the players took that to heart. And I don't think there's one character that has disadvantage on stealth. Maybe Brett's character does, but I don't think he does. But yeah, so they made their group fairly stealthy and they were able to kind of sneak past this ogre without them knowing it was there. And again, notice, you know, I mean, trying to think of how I can help you as a fellow GM or maybe a new GM. Notice that I did not go into this with a preconception of how the players, quote, should respond. I wasn't like, oh, I wanted this to be a combat encounter and I wanted to give them treasure. So they have to fight it. So I'm going to have them fail sneaking past it. Right. I didn't do that. Not only do I let the players decide what they do, but then I fairly adjudicate the results, because you could be a GM who lets the players do whatever they want to do, but you're still completely railroading them based on the results of what they do. Because every time they try to do something you don't want them to do, it doesn't work. And the only thing that works is the thing that you want them to do. And I've known GMs who run their games like that. And those aren't fun games to play in. So even though I wanted it to be a combat, even though I wanted to hand out treasure, I was fine with it turning out differently, which it did. So when the players wanted to sneak by, I had them make stealth checks. I checked that against the ogre's passive perception, I believe is how I did it. That's how I would usually do it. And they were able to sneak by. Not a big deal, because it's not like this is the only time in the campaign they can encounter an ogre, right? And next time they might encounter two ogres or four ogres, who knows? And the ogre was actually, or is actually, foreshadowing something else coming later in the campaign. So because of that, I know that they will get opportunity to face off against ogres again. So I'm not concerned about the fact that they didn't fight this particular ogre. It is kind of a shame that I wasn't able to give them the treasure that he had, but that's okay. I'll find an opportunity to give them treasure sometime in the future. There's always more opportunities. So even though it didn't go the way I thought it would, it didn't go the way I planned, it didn't go the way I really designed the encounter to go, I was actually really pleased with how this encounter went. I was really happy that the players reacted to the ogre in a more strategic, tactical way. Whether the real impetus for that was metagaming and knowing what the CR of an ogre is, or whether it was from a role-playing perspective of, I don't think my character would want to fight this big, scary, giant thing. Whatever the reasoning behind it was, the result was that the players weren't stupid players and just charged the ogre and attacked it thinking, oh, it's here, we must be able to fight it, right? They used their brains, they were tactical, they were strategic, and they decided that the rewards were not worth the risk. Cost benefit analysis is what we always called that in anthropology. So the cost was too much for the possible benefit, and it wasn't worth it in their calculation. So they avoided it. And I was really happy with that. It shows that they're thinking, I think that they're approaching encounters from a more in-character perspective. Or at the very least, it shows that they're not assuming that everything they come across in the world can be defeated, which means I've done my job as a dungeon master in setting expectations as for what kind of a game are we playing? What kind of a campaign is this? Because that is true. And now I know that the players understand that just because they stumble across something in the woods doesn't mean it's a fair fight. Doesn't mean they have any chance of defeating it. And so they're evaluating everything they come across strategically, which is good. And another thing really quickly that I'm trying to do here, and this is something I've been trying more and more to do specifically in fifth edition, is I try very hard not to ever use the monster manual name for a monster. So it's been a while since I ran this. I don't know for certain, but my goal, at least in this, was to never use the word ogre. And I'm pretty sure I did not use the word ogre until one of the player characters made a roll to see if they knew what this thing was, and they did. And at that point, I said, it's an ogre. But up to that point, all the times I described it and talked about it, I never used the word ogre. And there's good reasons for that. For one, the characters don't know that this is an ogre. And until that character made that roll that said, hey, I do know this is an ogre, the assumption is these are fairly low-level characters. We've never had an encounter with an ogre, so they've never had an encounter with an ogre. So they don't know what an ogre is. So calling it an ogre would be giving them information for free that they should have to earn. So that's one reason. Another reason is, as soon as I call it an ogre, then that is a monster in the monster manual on a specific page of the monster manual. And all of a sudden, there's all these assumptions. There's all this baggage attached to this creature now, especially for any players who are familiar with the ogre of the monster manual. So right away, as soon as I say ogre, players who are familiar with the ogre in the monster manual are making all kinds of assumptions. They're assuming it's a certain CR. They're assuming it has a certain number of hit points, maybe a specific number of hit points, or at least a certain range of hit points. They're assuming it has a certain armor class, a certain attack bonus, a certain damage output, certain vulnerabilities or invulnerabilities or resistances, right? They're making all these assumptions, right? Let's take a different example. Let's say a green dragon. If I tell you this is a green dragon, right away you assume, oh, it's immune to poison. It has a poison breath weapon. It has bite and claw attacks. It can fly, right? All these assumptions, because you know what a green dragon is, even if your character has never encountered one before. So even with the best intention players, like, we're not schizophrenic, right? We can't actually split our mind into different parts and have the different parts not know what the other parts are doing, right? So even if I'm the best player on the planet and I try to separate character knowledge and player knowledge, as soon as you tell me it's an ogre, I know things about that ogre, or I think I do. And I can't change that, right? I can't completely ignore that. I can try not to let it affect my decisions, but I really can't. Right? Because that knowledge is there. I can't make it not be there. So you can avoid a lot of that by not using the names in the monster. Don't tell them it's an ogre. First of all, one, make them figure it out. And second, maybe they never figure out. Maybe you never tell them what the thing is. And then that way they can't go look it up in the monster manual and say, oh, this is what I need to hit it. Or, oh, hey, it's vulnerable to fire, guys. Or, oh, hey, radiant damage is the only thing that'll hurt it, guys, right? You nip that metagaming in the bud. And it also, it's not just limiting metagaming. It's also to make it more enjoyable for the players. Because if you have players that are experienced players, and especially our DMs themselves, and they have all this knowledge about the thing in the Monster Manual, the longer you can keep them from making that connection, the better for them, because then there's some mystery and they don't know what this thing is, and they can actually discover things about it instead of pretending that they're discovering things about this thing they already really know about as a player. The other thing I do, in addition to trying to never use the name of the thing from the Monster Manual, is I change things as much as I can. I try very hard never to run a monster that's exactly as written in the Monster Manual. At the very least, I'll change its hit points. If I have time to do nothing else, I'll at least change its hit points. I used to always use the average number of hit points that are given. But now I only do that if I'm doing something on the fly and I didn't prepare it ahead of time. And even then, a lot of times I'll adjust it in some way. But when I prepare encounters ahead of time, I will either roll hit points or do something else to get a different number in that range, because I don't want players thinking, oh, this is a goblin and every goblin has 7 hit points. I don't want them to know how many hit points it has. And I don't want every monster to be the same. So just because you hit this goblin with one hit that did 7 damage and it took it out, doesn't mean when you hit this other goblin and do 7 damage, it's going to take it out. Because not every goblin's the same, right? And that goblin that's in the Monster Manual is an archetype. It's an example of an average goblin. It's not what any particular goblin would necessarily be like. So I think by doing those two things, by not using the names in the Monster Manual to not give that cue, and to change things up a little bit with your monsters, you can keep the players guessing and keep it fresh and let them discover things in your world instead of just reading it out of the Monster Manual. You know, you can change things like resistances, right? And, you know, have a creature that instead of resistance to fire, it has resistance to acid instead, just to keep the players guessing. And another thing, while I'm on this topic, another area you want to be careful is how you describe the monster, because you can give it away in your description. So, you know, if I want to describe this ogre and I don't want the players to realize it's an ogre necessarily, I want to be careful how I describe it, right? I might really play up the fact that it's a type of giant. So they're thinking, oh, maybe it's a hill giant, or maybe it's some other kind of giant we don't know about, instead of immediately thinking ogre or something like that. So think about how you're going to describe the monster and what kind of conclusions that's going to lead to. And you can either, you know, you can either just avoid leading the players to the obvious conclusion of what the monster actually is, or you could even try to mislead them into thinking it's something different, all in the way you describe it. All right. So now, concluding session 2. So for pacing, and I think I talked about this before, I wanted the player characters to reach the village at the end of the session, at the end of the second session. Originally, I thought maybe it'd be the end of the first session, but we didn't get there in the first session. So I'm like, end of the second session is the perfect time for them to get there. That way we can begin the third session with them entering the village and exploring it, meeting NPCs, all that good stuff. And I just, for me, that seemed like the best place to do that. So to that end, to facilitate being able to end the session precisely when they see the village and they're like, oh, we found it, but we don't have time to go there yet because the session's over. Like, that's kind of the cliffhanger at the end of the session. So to facilitate that happening, I had 2 more flexible encounters, which I've talked about flexible encounters in previous episodes of Behind the Screen. I had 2 more flexible encounters that I had fleshed out and prepared, as well as ideas for a few more encounters that I could have used if I needed to. So if we, you know, got to the end of the ogre encounter and I'm like, oh man, I got 2 hours left in the session, what do I do? I had encounters I could use if needed, just to pace the session so that we get to the village at the end of that session. Also, I'll point out that everything up to this point, including the unused encounters, was what I had prepared for the first session. So yes, I tend to over prepare, but I think it's better to over prepare than to under prepare. Because if you under prepare, then you get to a point in the session where you're kind of on your own and you haven't done any groundwork to help yourself out, which can be rough. But if you over prepare, the worst thing that happens is, well, now I don't have much to do for next week because we didn't use everything for this week. So I can use the rest of what I came up with for this week for next week, which gives me yet another week to come up with what's going on the next week. Because in the end, if you do it right, preparation is never wasted as a GM. So the prep I did for session one that I didn't use, I used for session two, which gave me more time in the week between sessions one and two to prepare other things that would come later in the campaign. I mean, I am doing so much homebrewing for this campaign that I will never run out of things to work on. There's always more stuff I can work on. And in fact, there's things I'm behind on. Like, I really need to flesh out Dianara's and Alondra's mystery cults more. Really need to do that. But I haven't done it yet. Just so much to do, so little time. So I wanted the player characters to see the village in the distance at the end of the session, because like I said, I think that's a good cliffhanger for the end of the session. The players have the next week to wonder about what they're going to find in the village. But they get the sense of accomplishment of, we found it. We hit this milestone. We've achieved our first goal as a group. And now we can spend a week wondering what we're going to find there. Also, I think it's a great way to start the third session, because we can jump right into the player characters exploring the village. They have the whole session to do so. We don't have to worry about them running out of time in the middle of exploring and meeting the NPCs and having to pick up where we left off a week ago. So it's just a great place to end the second session and a great place to begin the third session. So for session three, I'm assuming that the player characters will enter the village, meet some NPCs, find a place to stay, and start to try to figure out how the village is still around after 5 years on their own. And hopefully at some point they'll also remember to report into Druinda, their patron over in Alondria. All right. I'm just checking my runtime. So that is the conclusion of my discussion of session two. So in the next behind the screen, I'm going to discuss session three. And if we can get through all that in that episode, that will be the conclusion of these kind of preliminary behind the screens, really focusing on the setup of the campaign and the preludes and the first few sessions. And then, like I said at the beginning of this, moving forward, I'm really going to rely on you, on your questions and comments to direct where we take this series going forward. So I really urge you to get a hold of me, comment on these videos, ask me questions, tell me things you want me to talk about. Because, you know, once I finish the next episode, episode eight, I'm going to kind of wait on you guys to let me know what you want me to talk about. And I really want this to move more into a Q&A so that I can really talk about what you want me to talk about, because I don't want to waste a bunch of time producing videos about things that are obvious to people or people already know how to do or people don't care about. This series behind the screen is for you GMs out there to show you how I do things, and especially for newer GMs who are maybe GMing for the first time, or you haven't been doing it very long, or maybe you've only run pre-published stuff and you're wanting to start your own campaign of your own creation, maybe in your own world of your own creation. You are who these videos are for. So if that's you, or if you're finding these helpful in any way, please comment on the videos. Give me some feedback, give me some questions, give me some comments, so that I can use that going forward, so that future episodes of Behind the Screens can be as helpful to you as possible. And I'm probably, after I produce this next one, number eight, I'm probably just gonna, pump the brakes on this and kind of sit back and wait, for you guys to do your part and tell me where you want me to go next. So if a bunch of time is going by and there's no behind the screens, there's no behind the screens for a while. Could be because the stuff I want to talk about is too spoilery, but probably is because I'm not getting feedback and questions and I don't know what to talk about. So if you want more of these, please do your part and please reach out to me. And, you know, there's no such thing as a dumb question. If you have a question, ask it. If you have something you'd like me to talk about, please let me know. And, you know, all the other listeners or viewers who are for whatever reason afraid to reach out to me will probably thank you silently that you did so because they might have had the same questions. So anyway, thanks for tuning in. And again, we play Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific. Unfortunately, we haven't been playing every week for a variety of reasons. Players have stuff going on. I've got stuff going on. I've had migraines. I've had the flu. It's been fun times. We've got holidays coming. So, you know, we don't play every week. We play as often as we can, but when we play Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific. And, the best way to know when we're playing is to follow me on Twitter or, join the Game Master's Journey community on Google+, or, join the Starwalker Studios Discord server. I usually, you know, let it be known in all those places when we're going to stream next. But yeah. Thanks so much for watching, and thank you in advance for your comments and questions. I really appreciate it, and I know the other GMs out there do too. Game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at StarwalkerStudios.com/Game Master's Journey.